Hello and welcome back to Illumination, the Disney Lorcana podcast. My name is Max.
And I'm Sam.
And we are here on the precipice of set championships for Ursula's return this time. And we are talking over what to do if you're on a budget. I was trying to figure out a way to rhyme what to do if you're on a shoe and then like string budget, but I thought that was going a little far this quick into the podcast and I didn't want to sacrifice any potential listeners who are first timers. Welcome on in, all of you, new and old. Happy set championships. Hopefully you all do well slash have done well slash maybe we can help you if that doesn't actually fit your use case.
We get a whole month this time.
A whole month of weekends to do this. I think they really wanted to offset the stores that were having it on Fridays because that was just kind of like, whoa, they're doing them on Fridays. They said Saturday, Sunday. Now they're doing them on Fridays. So that was happening during Into the Inklands. I wasn't even aware of it or else I would have looked for it. So we just got to miss out on a couple opportunities, unfortunately. But not this time, because it's all month long. And we wanted to talk over what to do if you don't have the most money. Like, I'm talking green steel up to like almost like $900. So we're talking like just under $1,000 for some builds of green steel, which is crazy. And I'm talking like no enchanteds in there, not like foiled out. I'm talking about just
basic
green and steel cards costing bunches and bunches of money these days. We wanted to talk over a potential option for a budget build. And we went through and priced out some averages on Dreamborn.inc. If you haven't used it, a fantastic tool. They don't sponsor the podcast, but this is your chance, Dreamborn.inc. We put together a little layout of different budgets, and we wanted to pick a deck that fit the mold for budget, which is one of the cheaper decks you can build, right? $150 to $200 is about the right budget price range. If that number frightens you, or it concerns you, unfortunately, the cheapest deck I could find that even was on the playable roster came in around $125 on average. Not to say that you can't go out there and club somebody with a sock full of nickels. It is totally possible. But it's unlikely that you're going to be able to punch in the same weight class as people who are rocking a nearly $1,000 deck. We wanted to make sure that we came up with something in the realm of a realistic budget, which we put in around $150 to $200. And we wanted to make sure we came up with a deck that has a good track record, not like some super secret tech. One of the cheaper decks on the list was Amethyst Steel, and I just don't know as though that deck is quite there, at least enough to want to push people or encourage people to play it in a number and go, hey, those stupid idiots over Illumination told me to play this deck and it stinks. I don't have any real games into Amethyst Steel. A good testing partner of ours does, and they do pretty well with it, but it is a hard deck to pilot, and I know they get very frustrated, especially in the green steel matchup. So I didn't want to push people in a direction that was unknown or potentially not the clearest of waters. So we landed on a deck, and I'm sure it's going to be no surprise to those of you who play a lot of Lorcana that the deck we're choosing to highlight for this episode and recommend is our budget deck choice if you want to do well into the Ursula's Return meta is good old tried and true Ruby Amethyst. Looks a little different now in Ursula's Return. There's always been a sliding scale, and Ruby Amethyst is one that has been, going back to the first chapter meta, the most like hardcore control deck, to the point of mirrors where who could draw more cards with Magic Mirror. And they've shifted now to Ursula's Return to probably the most aggressive in build and play style that they've ever been, at least since the game has existed to this point. We want to talk over everything Ruby Amethyst, and I know this is a very well-known deck. So the good news is that there's a lot of data. There's a lot of ways you can tweak the deck and season to taste, and there is a lot of games you can go back and review to help you prepare for set championships. So not only are we trying to arm you with something that's affordable, we're trying to arm you with something that you can do some diligence on in the days leading up to your set champ or champs, depending on how many you're going to play in.
And something that stands a chance to win.
Exactly. This deck is a winning deck. It's placed probably more players in Lorcana Top 8s than any other archetype. It was the second place deck in both of the Challenger events. Granted, that was the Inklands meta, but that was still well represented into Chicago. So there is a lot of oomph in this deck. It's well positioned right now. We'll get into all of those things. So we wanted to give you the rundown. And luckily, Sam has been playing this particular deck, not only this build, but just this archetype for quite a while. I tried it. I don't like it. I think personally, I would like this build better than the previous builds. I liked it in the first chapter, but I liked Steel Song better. But I like it a lot now, and it is on the far end of more tempo and passive lore generation to win quickly than it used to be in activating Magic Mirror dozens of times and just using brooms and befuddles to not mill out. So times have changed for this deck. Sam, you want to run us through the deck's kind of plan?
Yeah, I think as you alluded to, the deck is definitely has the capacity to be more aggressive now, but you can also jump into that control deck later in the game if you need to. And I think it does a really good job of doing both things, being able to have that balance, especially depending on what deck you're playing. But the overall goal of this deck is to draw as many cards as you can, get as much passive lore as you can. The Mim package with Snake and Madam Mim Fox, you want to bounce your goats, bounce your rabbits to either gain lore or more cards. There's other cards like Maleficent Sorceress, where you draw a card when it enters.
Cards that draw when they leave. Now all your one drops draw when they leave.
Yep, your one drops, which my build, I go with Chernabog's Followers and Magic Broom, and I think a lot of people are on that, but there are still different one drops that the deck can play.
We're long since the days of like a 1-3 for one in most cases.
Right. Some builds run one or two still, because they might include the Teeth and Ambitions to do it on them. With Chernabog's Followers, you draw cards when it quests, you can choose to banish it to draw a card. With Magic Broom, the new Magic Broom, whenever you play a character, you can banish it. So you can quest with it, play a character, blow it up, draw a card.
Or in the late game, pay one, draw a card.
Yeah.
Which is pretty, pretty cool. Yeah, the deck's plan is very simple, right? From a very macro, high-level perspective, we're trying to gain passive lore through the use of card advantage and using our card advantage to help leverage tempo control early, by way of Madam Mims being overstatted and being able to pick up key cards to grant us more card advantage, and then turn that into just hard board control by way of Ladies and Chairs and Be Prepared. So it is a pretty sound game plan. They have the new version of Lady Tremaine, if you will, with the new song Be King Undisputed.
I love this card.
I was going to say Be King Unprepared, which is not correct.
That's not correct.
Be Unprepared. That's return all characters from your discard pile to play.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's not true. It's a card I made up. So that is what the deck's trying to do. And of course, the first thing you need to do in a game of Lurkana is you need to decide on how you're going to mulligan. And that's kind of step one. That's the first thing we're going to walk through here now that we've gone over the high level overview of what the deck is trying to do and how it's trying to do it. So we're talking mulligans here. And Sam, I want to talk kind of through three strategies, essentially, and then we'll talk about an ideal hand. I want to talk about cards we always want to mulligan, situational cards to mulligan depending, and then finally I want to talk about the things that are the most important to hang on to help us transition into that ideal hand. You've just flipped over 7 fresh cards, right? What are the cards that are insta flipping down, they're going back into the deck?
Be Prepared, Medusa / Ladies and Chairs, and Be King Undisputed are just going away.
And you also tend to mulligan your songs relatively aggressively.
Yes.
In the blind, right?
Even, in the blind, yeah.
Even Friends on the Other Side.
Mm-hmm.
Just because green decks are so prevalent, correct?
I don't want a green deck taking my Friends on the Other Side on turn two.
If Ursula, 2-drop Ursula Deceiver out of Emerald gets to snag your Friends on the Other Side, it is a disaster.
Yeah.
It's a complete disaster for you. Like that card, if you see a green card get inked or played on one, your second turn ink is most likely going to be Friends on the Other Side. If you haven't already mulliganed it, we're talking if you get it as the next set of cards that you
drew. I've gotten 2 in my opening hand after mulliganing them away, and then it just one gets sniped and there's nothing you can do about it.
You want to control it as much as you can. Obviously, there are things, and this is a good little mini lesson to pack in here. There are things inside of your control and things outside of your control. It's important, and I talk about this a lot on the podcast, making sure you're separating them. I can't help that I drew 2 Friends on the Other Side. I cannot help that my opponent elected to play Ursula Deceiver on 2 as opposed to Bucky, but it resulted in me discarding a Friends on the Other Side. There's nothing I could do about it. I couldn't ink quicker. I couldn't just hide it under my chair. That's against the rules. So there's no choice there, but to just suck it up and let them take the card. It's hard to want to mulligan a Friends just if you were, as your very first ink, not knowing. Like if you're on the play and you don't know what your opponent's on, just inking a Friends, especially over something that isn't maybe terribly useful a lot of the time, or maybe a duplicate, is difficult. But as soon as you see that sign, you have to know, okay, it's time to start inking the songs, because otherwise they're going to get stripped out of my hand. And like we talked about, that's a game losing proposition. So what are the cards you're going to keep sometimes, cards you're not going to keep other times, depending on the texture of your other cards in hand? These are kind of like, I'll mulligan them about half the time. Situationally, I mulligan these.
Merlin Rabbit, just because it's uninkable. So sometimes it's a little difficult, especially depending on the rest of your hand and how many inkable inkables you have. Goat, I would say most of the time I throw back goat, but if I'm light on inkables, I might keep one.
It's fair.
Snake, I think that's just better late game anymore.
Yeah. A lot of decks are trimming on their snakes. So we're seeing like 2 to 3 as opposed to the usual full 4.
And castle. I'd say most of the time I'm going to send back castle, but there are definitely matchups where it's useful. Also, I don't mind inking one early on.
No. It's one of those cards that's phenomenal late and you want to see it as close to as an end game proposition as possible. Sometimes you're like, oh crap, I'm on 3 castles because I'm just going to castle rush and see if my opponent can deal with it, which is good unless it's the mirror, really. And then we have the, I never want to mulligan these except under very specific circumstances or as close to never as possible.
That would be the one drops, either one of them. Flynn Rider, Brawl. I like to have a Fox in my opening hand. I think you really want that 1, 2, 3. Plus having an option for removal is great. And Brawl, I think, is the best one because it can't be sniped from your hand by Ursula.
Right.
So I really like having those. But I think one drop, two drop, and then one of the three drops is just ideal.
Makes sense. So your ideal hand looks something like 1 to 2 1 drops, Flynn Rider, Frenemy, Sisu, Emboldened Warrior, or Maleficent Sorceress, Brawl, Fox, and then like 1 to 2 other cards, depending on how many of those aforementioned cards are in your opening hand.
Right. I would be very happy with that.
Cool. Well, that makes sense for mulliganing. Now that we've got our 7 cards, though, we're going to have to start inking them. What is your general plan? For the most part, how are you inking in this deck on the whole? This is obviously going to change very drastically in game 2, or if you know what your opponent's on in a top 8 situation where you've been playing in the same little shop all day and now everybody's like, oh no, he's on this.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're going to know and you're going to be able to do this. But if you have advanced knowledge or you're on game 2/3, if you're playing best of 3, you're going to need to have a general, more specific plan than what this is. But I'd say just on the whole, how are you going to be inking? What informs your ink choices? How do you handle the process when you're looking at a hand?
Early on, I would say what informs it is usually the cost. I'll ink higher cost characters / Queen's Castle. I'll ink multiples if I have 3 Foxes in my opening hand. Maybe I'll mulligan one. I hate to do it. Same with multiple Mauis or multiple of anything I might ink.
So if you start to see duplicate situational cards, you'll mulligan for sure.
Yes.
And the ideal prospect, the thing that guides your inking decisions, is making sure you have a curve of playables. You want to play a 1, you want to play a 2, you want to play a 3.
I think that's the most important thing in this deck against most decks you're going to play, is having that curve.
I think that's fair to say. Situationally, is there anything that has a high threshold, like this card's the best card against certain decks, and or this card is unplayable against other decks, and so they're like the keep or mull, just it shifts from like this is a hardcore keep to nope, you can get rid of this one depending on the matchup.
I think Brawl's one.
I think it's probably the most obvious choice here for sure.
Especially later in the game, if you have a Medusa in your hand, you don't necessarily need that Brawl because it's going to do the same thing she can do. Sisu, I think, is situational. If I'm playing against a deck that doesn't have very many cards in their hand, that's not going to do much for me. 2 lore is nice. I'm not running the big Sisu. I don't need it as a shift line.
Right.
So she's just really good in early game against a deck that draws a lot of cards to keep my Flynn getting that 3 lore. So I think she can go, depending.
And what are the things you want to ink the least for the most part?
Goat and Fox, I'd say.
And Goat's rough because you sometimes will ink it, especially if it's in your opening hand, because it's just like, oh man, this isn't going to be good till like turn 9.
Right. I also don't want to ink Friends if I can help it. But as we said earlier, I will if I'm playing a green player.
Right. Totally makes sense. So I think when it comes to the ink plan, obviously the opponent's deck choice informs a lot of your play pattern on how you're inking cards.
Yeah.
On the whole, you're trying to play to a curve. Green Steel obviously upending that a little bit because you want to retain things like Brawl that don't add to the board. And you also aren't as interested in slapping down units on the board because you don't want to reduce your hand to willy-nilly.
Right. Against Green Steel, if I'm going to play a card on the board, most likely it's going to replace itself.
And that makes a lot of sense. Like Brawl against the mirror, where you have a lot of overstatted characters, loses its taste pretty quickly. Same with Blue Steel, where they go Mr. Smee into Cogsworth. It's like, okay, I can't Brawl any of this. So it loses its merits. But against Green Steel, it's like, I have to have this immediately to answer that first Diablo, or I am in big trouble. Because when they Diablo, you play a rabbit, you feel like the worst Lorcana player ever, because you're letting them draw extra cards, but you have to find an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels really bad. And it makes sense that the Green Steel matchup is the one that changes the game plan so drastically, because I would say that is probably the toughest matchup for this deck.
I think so. 100%.
On the other side of the coin, talking about another very common matchup a lot of people are going to see set champs is the Ruby Sapphire control decks. So we're talking about the ramp style decks that play Hyrum on four, play one jump ahead on two, or playing Fishbone Quill, or now the Dragon Statues. This deck plays a little differently, and your playstyle tends to have to adapt to that because now you're really good with your Flynn lines and like playing to the board, questing hard in the beginning of the game before they can assert control becomes much, much more important, where you can't just put down Brooms and Chernabog's followers as willy-nilly against right. the green steel decks.
Yeah, I think against the Ruby Sapphire deck, your game plan is just get as much lore as you can before they get to the ink where they're throwing down their Tamatoas and their Lucky Dimes.
Right, and I think the green steel matchup you play at your most conservative, where you're playing the most like a control deck. Like, I don't want to play anything until I start to answer, like, be King Undisputed into Medusas. Mm-hmm. That's when you want to start to play the game, where against red-blue, it's the opposite, where you're unleashing the aggressive bent of the deck. Like, I just want to slap down as much lore as I can, as fast as I can, and try to clean up the game with Queen's Castles. And I think for the most part, a lot of the other decks, whether it's the Mirror, whether it's Blue Steel or Steel Song, any of these other decks that are common in the meta, I think you just tend to stick to your basic game plan. Play on a good curve, play tightly, utilize removal, utilize card advantage. Balance
your characters.
Yeah. Like, that's your game plan is the same for such a wide variety of decks that this also makes an attractive choice for a set champs, especially for somebody who's not grinding games, and none of us are grinding games as aggressively now with Pixelborn no longer operating. We just don't have as many games under our belt. So being able to use a deck that largely enacts a proactive game plan and the same style of game plan in the bulk of its games is really attractive because you get the play patterns and the repetitions and everything under your belt, and then you start to be able to play a variety of ways against the decks that require a dramatic shift in direction and play style, like the Ruby Sapphire decks and the Emerald Steel decks. So it's really neat that this deck can offer up a lot of consistency in addition to a more attractive price tag. But whatever you end up playing at your set champs, remember, you're there to have fun and to meet people and to grow the community. Community's never been more important than it is now. You don't have the option to just go, oh, forget these people, I'm going to go play on the internet. It's a lot harder to do now. It's still very doable, but it's just become more difficult. It still requires a digital community. So it's really important to enjoy yourself, have fun, try not to gatekeep, try not to be that person who comes in and upsets a local meta. Just be fun, be excellent to each other, as Bill and Ted would so often teach us. And remember, the most obvious and most direct way to win a game of Lorcana is
keep questing.